the Monday Tom and Curly Show. Let's get Tommy in here. Of course, we always like to do with new music since Tom has not been here since about the 8th of October. We've asked you, the listeners, to tell us what song you'd like to hear for Tom to come in with. Here's Nick from Orcas Island with Dell and the Funky Homo Sapiens. Get off of my couch. Hold on, Tom. He's rapping. Like I don't have a home. Brothers on my couch so much there's like foam coming out the seams, and a pair of jeans is missing from my closet. I wonder why I even bother being friendly. They're running my ass like 5,000. They went and there we go. Get off my couch with your lazy ass, all right? That's you, Tom.
Funky Tom here.
Hey, Funky Tom. All right. Quick recap. Let's go around the room. Andrew, how was your weekend on a scale of 1 to 10? 1 to 10, how was the weekend?
My weekend was a 8.
Oh, Tom, 1 to 10, how was your weekend on the couch?
I'd say about a 5, maybe a 6.
All right. Andrew in the lead. Jacob, do you have a weekend?
Yeah, I don't think I beat any. I maybe a 7.
We'll find out later on why Andrew had such a good weekend. But first, let's get started with you. Should get on a waiting list now if you want to get yourself some child care. It's crunch time. It takes a toll on the providers and the parents as well. The story really well done by Seattle Times, basically pointing out that even if you aren't even pregnant yet, even if you don't even have a boyfriend or girlfriend, even if you don't intend, even if you're not even ovulating, if you're an 8-year-old girl who's thinking about it, you should probably start to line up some child care for yourself 20 years out. Right, Tom?
And 8-year-old boys, too. They're part of the child care situation. Yeah, this is interesting. We know that we have this boom in population here in Seattle and you know, King County for that matter. And the problem is that right now we have expanded our child care resources, but not nearly enough to keep pace. So right now they figure there's enough child care space to accommodate about half of the kids, you know, under 5, so 4, you know, infant to 4 that we need or that, you know, is available there. And so how do you handle it? Well, you've got to get on waiting lists, and the Seattle Times does a great job of profiling parents. The moment they get confirmation that they're pregnant, they try to get on waiting lists. And the problem is because it's so tight, the competition, you have to get on, like, there's one couple where was on 9 different waiting lists, and each of those waiting lists require a deposit of somewhere between $25 and $100. Mm-hmm. So that gets expensive just to kind of hold your place in line.
Yeah.
They also say that now just waiting until you get pregnant is not soon enough, let alone waiting until you have a child. But now they say that if you are anticipating or trying, they actually have a category when you apply to say, how old is your child? You could just say trying and get on in anticipation of. It's that scary out there, or that difficult, I guess.
I find having a 16-year-old is very trying. Let's say this, Tom. So that sounds like we have a supply problem. We don't have a demand problem. We have a supply problem. So then as a libertarian conservative, I look at this as how do we increase supply?
Yes.
So what you do is you get the federal government out of there, and you stop with the burdensome regulations that the federal government puts in place. So right now, I'll increase the number of places available to people, and I'll drop the price 9% if we change the ratio of child care provider to child from 4 to 6. If we increase it by one kid, what they found is that it has absolutely little or no effect upon the child's ability to get cared for. So if you just broaden it just a little bit, you went from like 4 to 6 kids per child care provider to 4 to 7, you would then be able to reduce the price by about 9%. And then you could have other things as well. You get federal government out of there with what they put in place. You allow people to have more freedom of choice. And you also allow the parents to be able to say, well, you know what? I'm okay with this ratio or that ratio. You let them pick and choose as opposed to the burdensome government coming in with regulations that drives down supply and drives up price.
Okay, fair enough. But the burdensome government is there to provide sort of like a baseline that we will not put kids at risk. And so right now we have, this isn't true of older kids, toddlers, but at the infant ratio, at least this state has decided that you need to have, one teacher for every four infants.
Right.
And if you up that, that's seen as a safety standard. And the problem is if under the libertarian rule where you have no government functions, you could then have people, you could have, 10, 15.
Oh, imagine 20. This. Or somebody who's not trained by the federal government what they're supposed to do, which we already have. It's called stay at home with grandmother, stay at home with aunt. So what you do is because the burdens in federal government puts in these ratios, then what happens is the person that can't afford it then ends up having the kids stay with the older sister or whatever. Now, that's even less regulated. So, oh, my gosh, we better have the government come into the private home. But you can't have the government come into the private home. You could fix it in the front end. Okay. Which is reduce the burdensome. No, you say it's a safety thing. I say let the mom and dad.
Thing.
Hold on. But let the mom and dad decide. You know what? I'm okay with this ratio. Yep. It's government provided this way, but I'm going to choose this instead. And my kid seems to be doing pretty well. Or my kid's not flourishing here. So I take my kid out and put my kid somewhere else.
That's
you should be able to have more flexibility in the marketplace and let the customer decide. Let the parents decide. Why is the federal government all knowing about what's best for the kid?
They're not all knowing. We are.
They certainly are. They determine the ratio. They determine the ratio.
Yes,
they've also determined the education level that the child care provider has to have.
That's right. And we provide that because we do not want to turn these child care centers into puppy mills that are basically just there churning out. We want to be able to guarantee a parent that your
right,
child
the parent
is not
is
going
so
to be
dumb.
Injured.
The parent's so dumb. The parent's going to send the kid to a puppy mill.
It's not dumb. The idea is that it's whatever. If you set a base standard, John, we're not talking about a high end requirement. We're just like a base standard that when you drop your kid off at this daycare center, you should be guaranteed, or the expectation is that kid is not going to come home with a broken arm or some fatal disease.
Yeah.
The idea is that we just have certain standards, and that's all that they're asking for. But one of the other problems about there's a part of me when I was reading this saying, why don't we let the market determine what these teachers make, though?
Right.
Do you realize that the average childcare teacher only makes $30,000 a year?
Yeah.
Even the directors of the child care centers, they only make $43,000 a year. That is not very much. So the problem is what they ought to do, because it's hard to attract people with those low salaries, that they should charge more. The problem is that hurts the families that are being used, and it's this societal balance that's trying to be created so that people can afford child care at the same time that people that work in child care are fairly compensated.
Right.
I think if we paid child care workers the same as we even paid teachers who are not extravagantly reimbursed,
$90,000 a year in perks and
benefits. That would be a big improvement.
Well,
but right now we're not used to, because we never did this, we're not used to expecting to pay for child care like we end up having to now, because the economic situation is such that most parents need to work, both parents need to work under most circumstances.
Right.
And so we require child care.
Okay.
It's a tricky social dilemma we're in.
Why does a programmer who's 24 years old, or my nephew who is 20, get paid $9,000 for 3 months worth of $9,000 a month for 3 months at Facebook? Because he's in high demand, because people want his skills.
Oh, right.
The problem with the child care provider, Tom, is the skill set is very limited. You're basically looking after these kids, making sure that they don't choke on something. You're changing their diapers. And that's what you get paid for, that skill set. So there's not a lot of demand. So somebody comes in and they get a job working in child care. That's what you make. You make $15 an hour or $16 an hour. What would you do?
Right.
You'd want to pay them more to attract more of them, which drives up the price and forces more people out of the market, so that now they're spending time, oh my gosh, with an auntie or a grandmother who is not federally checked out on all the rules and regulations regarding child care.
That's right. But no, the irony, in fact, of this article, they say that these child care workers actually have to have all these educational requirements, like a college degree and all these kinds of things.
Right.
They say they do excess work and education in order to do these jobs, and they're even less compensated than a teacher.
Good, then
so
we agree.
Like we do teachers.
Then we agree. Get the federal government's regulation as to how much schooling that the person who's changing the kid's diaper has to have. If you reduce that number, take that down to a high school degree, then you'd find out that the person would actually have more people in there, and you drive down the price because you'd increase supply.
Well, John, we do. Yeah, but they actually, you know, it's funny that you're suggesting that there that you can get, and families of your ilk, even of my ilk, John, can afford nannies, and nannies don't come with all those kinds of requirements, it sounds like, and they charge a lot more. So the idea is that this actually could be, if we've seen it as a societal effort, just like with teachers, we have school districts that we guarantee a certain education, one of these federal burdens that you're
complaining
about.
It is a federal
about.
Burden.
In this particular case, you know, nannies, most parents at the average parent can't afford nannies. It's just for the upper crusty of us.
Right.
Can afford that. And I don't know what kind of requirements nannies have, but it may be less than what childcare workers require.
Wow.
Because it's in kind of a context. I don't know. We'll have to check into that.
Well, apparently the upper crusties don't care about their child's safety then if they're trusting it to a person who hasn't passed federal rules and regulations. Maybe one-on-one.
Because they can afford it.
I see a lot of parents that get the nanny and then they say, hey, do you mind taking care of the Anderson's kid as well? And they're like, okay, I'll charge this. So they have like three kids and the nanny's in there. I looked at the number one country as far as U.S. ranking latest government-supported time off for parents, and then support for parents, and then childcare. Estonia beats every other country. Crazy for paid leave and then also additional childcare. Estonia is at the top of the list as far as kind of care for parents. I got no problem with it. I understand that if we're a stronger society, I know I tried to figure it out. I didn't have time to look at it in all the details. But if we want to be a stronger society, then we have to have a stronger family, because the family is the first part of the child becoming a productive member of society. So with a child without care, without love, without attention, ends up hurting us down the road. So you get a person who has a kid, and then that kid is not taken care of. That kid ends up turning into a criminal, and then we pay, what, $35,000 to $40,000 a year to house him in a prison and $200,000, $300,000 to have police come after him. So you pay the little bit up front, apparently fix it later on, and then we have a better society, right? We agree there?
Well, yes, but okay. How much are we willing to pay for that? For instance, would we allow, as a society, because we have to make these general rules, that so anytime a child is born or adopted, would we be willing to pay that person's salary to stay home so they don't lose it on the front end, and then we allow for them to raise the kid in the home? I think we already think we're overtaxed. I think that would just be another step. But I think if we could agree that, yeah, if the family structure is that important, maybe it would be worth it to us to pay some of our hard-earned taxes to let Louise or Bill stay home to raise their infant.
Perhaps somebody should let Bill Belichick stay home sooner with his parents, because he made a very bad call with the Miami Dolphins. So this is now being referred to as what, the miracle?
In Miami.
Okay. Will this set it up well enough, or do we need Tom to give us some more details on it?
Well, it's the broadcasters from Miami
explaining it.
Doing their call.
Okay, here we go. So okay, no, that the Patriots should have beaten the Dolphins. Everybody agrees Patriots should beat the Dolphins. And this is now being described. I think it's a 69-yarder. Is that what it was? It was final few seconds of the game, or what was it? Last play of the game, basically, right?
They are, okay, so just to set this up, they're on the 31-yard line, Miami is, on their own. So they are almost 70 yards away. There's 7 seconds left in the game. And so everyone's expecting a Hail Mary pass from Ryan Tannehill, the quarterback, to go 65, 70 yards in the air for an effort to win the game.
And it's classic. And normally these plays end with an interception, because what you do is you put your defense out there to be able to get guys that have great hands. So you put the secondary is full of sometimes receivers and stuff. So it's going to be receiver on receiver, basically, because it's going to be a free-for-all. The quarterback drops back and just chucks the thing downfield, 70, 60 yards, whatever, and then everybody jumps up in the air for the ball. And in most cases, wouldn't you say it fails?
Oh, of course. That's why it's called a Hail Mary.
All right. So here we go. This is what everybody expected. Belichick expected it as well. And
Tannehill, last shot, back to throw. They throw it down. They try to pitch it, and they do. To Parker. Parker pitches it. And it's Greg! 30, 20, Gronkowski's got a tackle. Oh, that's it!
Jeez. We're modulating.
Unbelievable. Are you kidding me? Oh, that is unbelievable.
I don't.
It doesn't work on radio.
Believe what I just saw.
Isn't the classic backyard thing? So the one guy runs and he pitches it back to the other guy. So everybody's lateraling it behind each other, and then finally one guy breaks free. The problem that Belichick, how does Belichick make a huge mistake on this one?
Well, so the thing is, and what's fun about this is that Belichick is considered like the genius coach.
Yeah.
And so what did he do? He decided, like you often do, like you explained, John, you put receivers in, you expect this big long pass. So the last line of defense, one of their best receivers is this huge tight end, Rob Gronkowski. He's like 6'7" and 250, but he's strong as hell, and he's great with his hands.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's the last defense. Well, Belichick got outsmarted, because normally you'd never put a big tight end in to play pass defense. Well, in this particular case, because they threw it short and then pitched and pitched and pitched rather than throwing a long ball, you couldn't take advantage of Rob Gronkowski's strength and his height to pass it down. And so Rob Gronkowski is the last guy that he has to kind of tackle him. And the guy with the ball just kind of jukes him, and he kind of like stumbles over himself because he's not the most fleet of movers. He's just a big, strong guy. He practically falls down in his effort to get near the guy, and the guy scores the touchdown. So it's like, the great Bill Belichick was anticipating something, put in different personnel, and the Miami Dolphins brilliantly came up with a play that worked against the replaced defense. The funny thing is, the only thing that works less often than the Hail Mary is that, hey, throw it short and pitch back and keep lateraling. And this is one of the rare things where it actually worked, and it was on the last play of the game, and it knocked off the always winning Patriots.
It's that the reason it's always so dramatic is it's such a crazy play. And if it works, we talk about it. If it doesn't work, it's just, we've forgotten about it. Everybody's just like cleaning up the guacamole, like whatever. But when it happens, and when it actually effectively works, you're like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Because everyone's about, oh my God, oh my God. The same exact thing happened. I think it was in the Saints. I forget what it was. It worked. The guy goes all the way down, and then the John Connell or whatever his name was missed a field goal.
Missed extra point?
Next extra point. Remember that one, Tom?
Oh, yes.
Same sort of thing. Like, oh, so they went all the way down.
Finish.
It all worked, and the guy misses the extra point. All right, anyway, we'll come right back. Let's see. This guy's up on stage. He's been invited by the Asian American something or other association at a college, and it was called Shock Culture, or Culture Shock was the name of the event. The comedian gets up and says something that he thinks is not very offensive, but after about 10, 15 minutes, they come up on stage and take the microphone away from him. I got to warn you, if you're somebody who's easily offended, you might not want to listen to the next segment. Right back.
Can't wait to hear from Andy on the road less traveled. Go Pats, eh?
Laura Keel. Laura Keel, 833 Ask Laura, 833 Ask Laura. Last name is Keel. First name is Laura. If you need any mortgage help, it's Laura Keel. That's the one to call. All right. At one point, do we find out why Andrew had an 8 on a scale of 1 to 10 for the weekend?
Maybe next hour?
Yeah, maybe next hour. Andrew, get ready to justify it, because Tom came in at a 5.
5 or 6.
No, you can't change it now.
No, I said 5 or 6.
I have you down as a 5. Okay, here we
That's
go.
That's good.
All right. All righty. I don't know this comedian, but he used to be a writer at Saturday Night Live, and he is Indian American, which gives him a couple of points as far as victim status, but apparently not enough. He was performing on a college campus. Where was he? What college? Columbia. Oh, boy. He's at Columbia, and the Asian American Alliance has this event they're going to call Shock or Culture Shock Reclaim. And this comedian gets up there, and he's doing his bit. I don't know how far into his set he is, but he cracks this joke. And again, warning to anybody that may be highly victimized in their own mind. Here we go. You ready? Here's the joke. Quote, no one looks in the mirror and thinks, this black thing is just too easy. Let me add another thing to it, meaning being black and gay. The setup to the joke. And that was the thing that he said that apparently started to upset people when he said, you know, this thing about being gay and black, I mean, it's like the gay cannot be a choice. There's no way being gay is a choice, because it's not like you look in the mirror and you say to yourself, man, this black thing's just not working. I think I'll try something else. I'll add the gay to it. That's the joke that he made, but apparently people were upset about it, so they got up on stage and took the microphone away from him. This is not that big of a story. This sort of stuff happens all the time, that people don't think something's funny if it offends their feelings, right?
Okay, wait. I don't think you're quite doing justice to what happened. But yeah, that's the basic thrust of the joke, you know, mm-hmm. that he says, no black dude wakes up and thinks that being a black man in America is too easy. No black dude says, I'm going to put on a Madonna halter top and some Jordans and make an Indian dude real uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. That's not a choice. So that's the basic joke. And it wasn't like people then stormed the stage because they were so... instead, he says, that joke, which he's told on a lot of different campuses, it has varying reactions. A lot of times people laugh, but sometimes it bombs. Mm-hmm. This joke just bombed. There was nobody in the audience that reacted to it. And 5 minutes later, he just carried on with it. The people, the organizers of the, it was supposed to be like a 50-minute set, mm-hmm. and this is about 20 minutes in, and then they decided after about 5 minutes of more jokes, they came in and stopped it. So I just want to make sure that people understand the organizers were the ones who decided, okay, we're going to do it, and it wasn't like an immediate decision. Clear discussion. This wasn't working. Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
So, and you're right that this happens more often than not. I wouldn't say more often than not. It does happen frequently enough that Jerry Seinfeld has said in the past that he doesn't like working college campuses because so many people are so easily offended. What's great about this particular comedian, though, is that he writes this opinion piece for the New York Times, and he kind of analyzes what's going on with the college crowds and why they react to the way he reacts and why he as a comedian does what he does. Mm-hmm. And that's what's valuable. He claims that he doesn't think, you know, people are worse, like college campuses are worse now than they were 20 years ago because the individuals are worse or more sensitive. He thinks it's the way we consume things, that because of social media and this 24-hour news cycle, that we have what we do is we have so much cacophony coming at us that we look for shortcuts to get to the point of whatever stories we have.
Uh-huh.
And those shortcuts are why these trigger warnings kind of exist. It's that he thinks these shortcuts prevent you from listening and determining what is actually being said. They fail you, but a lot of times it's easier to use those shortcuts or trigger warnings because it's a way to cut out so much of the cacophony of 24-hour news cycles and Twitter and social media and all that. And that, actually, I think, is a pretty sophisticated way of looking at why we even go to things like trigger warnings. They have their purposes, but they can be overplayed.
I always make the argument that we live in a victim society world where the bigger your feelings and the more offended you are, you move up on the hierarchy scale. So there's this thing called intersectionality, which basically says that the idea is that and the problem with intersexuality is that the victim who is the most oppressed is always changing. And there's like everybody's opinion matters, but not if you're a white guy who's in their 50s. Your opinion doesn't matter as much as somebody who may be gay and white. Or the gay white woman doesn't have as much opinion credibility as the gay black woman, but then she is usurped by the gay black Muslim woman, and then or the trans Muslim woman trumps everybody else. Because the thing is, it's like how oppressed are you by society? So you have a list of like cards that have been dealt to you, and you throw those out. So you silence anybody you want based upon I was deeply offended by that. Well, why were you deeply offended? Well, because I feel this, and this. The one guy said that who was upset about the thing and asked them to be taken down. They asked the guy to get off the stage. Says blatant anti-blackness. It's like the joke is sensitive to the fact. They said, well, you can't make a joke about black people because you're not black. He goes, no, I'm observing, and my observation is there's no way. His point is gay is not a choice because you would never choose it to add to the continued discrimination of one being black and then being gay. I thought it was a brilliant joke. It's kind of not overly funny, but it basically works. And this is what he does. But in today's world where your feelings trump everything else and people who are more oppressed get more credit and more power than somebody else who's not.
Okay, so I reject your take on intersectionality, but it is about how all of these the people that are out of the power structure, how they crisscross in terms of the kind of the oppressive hierarchy of society.
Sure.
That,
imagine.
You climb a ladder,
yeah.
You don't trump people. It's just explaining what your life is like. But, John, basically, just what you did is what he's calling out you for is the same thing that you're calling the students out for. And this is from his essay. When older people, like John Curley,
yeah.
call students today oversensitive, we're doing the same thing that we accuse the college students of doing, jumping to a predetermined conclusion based on the action of a small group.
Mm-hmm.
That this generalization about college students is not unlike racists thinking every brown person is a terrorist.
Yeah.
And what he says, the lesson from what happened to him at Columbia, he says, wasn't that these kids are overly sensitive. It was that he got all sorts of emails and social media messages to him supporting what he did,
mm-hmm.
students apologizing for what happened at Columbia.
Yeah.
And people, there, he says three Columbia students actually came to his next gig somewhere else just to personally apologize for him. And he mm-hmm. realized that there are, you know, a certain group of people that can be offended, but there are also other people that do not respond that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that, unfortunately, the small group controls the bullhorn
in
any kind of interchange.
Not always.
Right.
Nope, so not always.
We can't
the small group does not control the microphone.
Well, that's
the
his
small,
quote.
In, right, his
the
thing
small
is,
group controls the bullhorn.
Right. If you can prove that you are oppressed. You being if you're part of a small group, but your opinion doesn't matter as much because you're white and maybe straight, you don't have as much power. Smallest group that is most oppressed has the most amount of power because feelings trump everything else.
But that's obviously not true because he said all these people came in response. In fact, you could say that a white male is the one who's born with a bullhorn. Others are trying to get their bullhorns in sideways.
Would you give your bullhorn back, Tom? You obviously didn't earn it. You're a white male with a white privilege, so therefore you should give it up. Give up your job right now. Give it to a black person.
I definitely feel like I was born privileged.
You should. Then you need to give it up. So Tom's going to know because Tom didn't earn it. Right, you didn't earn it.
We're both giving it up.
I'm not giving it up. You start. We'll start with you. You give up your job to a gay black man.
My bullhorn says to take away your bullhorn.
That's what liberals do. We're right back. All right, Tom. Jacob just texted you an audible. We're going to get this one in here. To me, when I read the article, I'm like, well, this seems like something like four kids in high school would come up with, and it would be part of the April Fool's newspaper idea, right? You were on the high school yearbook, I'm assuming, and newspaper.
I was the editor of the high school paper, you bet.
Were you also involved in the yearbook?
I was until I got the lead in the musical and had to drop out, but I was for the first half of the year.
Every question leads to a high school musical is the answer for you.
And why shouldn't it?
By the way, my friend was saying, Simone was saying yesterday, you and Tom should sing We Three Kings and get Jacob to sing as well at the big radio show tomorrow. You will not be at the radio show tomorrow, right?
I'm afraid not, John, but I'll be there in spirit. But I would love to sing the We Three Kings. You know, that's the epiphany, that a celebration I have every year. It's to commemorate the arrival of the three wise men to the stable, and We Three Kings is one of the themes.
Yeah, that's a good one. All right, well, listen, here's the story from the it's a newspaper. Well, let's just play CBS Philly News. Here we go.
And just days after their local newspaper closed down, a Missouri town is now getting a new one.
And the new paper's editor says this paper will be a fun paper. Natalie Sanders says the paper will include local news and promote the small town where it will be published. The town is on historic Route 66 and known for quirky attractions. The name of the paper is also getting some chuckles. It's called the Uranus Examiner, but not everybody apparently thinks it's funny.
I think that the Pulaski County Examiner, for example, would have been a real hit.
I want to see it succeed. That name does not indicate a serious newspaper.
All right. And what happened to it, Tom?
It survived for five editions, and that was it. And it was shut down. And the newspaper, producers, the owners, blame it on how uptight the fuddy-duddy citizens are.
Mm.
So what I don't understand, is there a city called Uranus, Missouri and Uranus, Missouri?
No.
Okay. because this says it's an unincorporated tourist spot along historic Route 66, and it says it's the byline says it's from Uranus, Missouri.
Oh, okay. So I did just Google it, and it looks like there is, yeah, like you said, unincorporated. It's just along okay, there, so, but yeah.
So it's not a completely made up name. The funny thing is that it's the Examiner instead of. You know, so Uranus Examiner is what's funny, not the Uranus part of it. I got it. Well, I would think a town named that would have to have a sense of humor, so why not play with the Examiner way?
Well, it's nice to know that standards still can continue to be upheld when it comes to things having to do with your rear end. So the transit system in New York City has rejected two ads, Tom. One of them, you see a man sitting on the toilet reading a newspaper, and then you see a woman sitting on a toilet. Actually, they're both sitting on bidets. So it's a bidet company called Tushy. And the ad that was supposed to go up inside the metro or inside the subway cars were, stop wiping your butt, start washing with Tushy. And then the other one says, this is with a woman, nothing says I love you like a clean beehole. MTA came along and said, I'm sorry. I am sorry. You have violated our standards of decency that contains profanity and slang terms for genital or anus, and therefore you will not be able to put your ads up.
And bidets are so classy, but beeholes are not.